Thank you, Mike, for coming on and joining me on the podcast today. It's great to have you and be able to speak with you. You are the a vice president at Founders Fund, as well as an entrepreneur in residence over there. You're also the founder and CEO of Pirate Wires, an interesting media company that sort of operates at the intersection of tech and politics and culture. And, you know, it started with Pirate Wire Substack, but now you've got a few different sort of brands or verticals under there. There's the White Pill, which I think launched a couple months ago, the industry shortly after that, and Pirate Wires podcast as well. So you're doing a bunch of stuff and it's all great content. I've enjoyed it a lot over the years, starting with, you know, Pirate Wires and your Twitter. So it's great to be able to speak with you. I think the best place for, you know, for those who aren't as familiar to get started would be to tell your story from as early as you're willing to start to where you are today and talk about some of the decisions you made along the way.
Well, great. Thanks for having me. My story. So I guess the sort of Founders Fund story for me begins in New York City. I actually just wrote a little bit about this for Pirate Wires. I just interviewed Peter. We just published that today, Friday. I used to be an editor at Penguin Books, and I was in the habit back then of just kind of reaching out to writers who I liked. Peter wrote an essay for Cato Magazine, hit him up, and he responded. Through that, we became sort of acquainted. We get coffee through specifically something called the Seasteading Institute is where we first met. I was throwing meetup groups for them. It was a nonprofit of his. And eventually he brought me on to Founders Fund to work on his class at Stanford called CS183, which became his book Zero to One. So I was sort of like me and a colleague of mine, Scott Nolan, built out that class. It was sort of like it was kind of like a TAing job, but it was really like an editorial job, just kind of distilling all Peter's thinking into chapters, essentially. And separately doing sort of networking events and things like that for Founders Fund. That evolved into a brand role. And pretty quickly, I took over the brand. Sort of, no one was that sort of on brand back then, so I just did it myself, and became just like today I'm the CMO of Founders Fund, and maybe a few years ago started Pirate Wires, which is where I write. I raised a little bit of money for that and have a team there. That's my media company, and I guess that's kind of who I am.
Awesome. Well, appreciate you sharing that. And it's definitely an interesting story. Everyone at Founders Fund seems to have a very interesting story that's far from direct in terms of, like, you know, it's not filled with a bunch of partners who graduated college and went into banking or consulting and then did this and ended up in venture. Everyone's got a very sort of unique story. I want to go back just briefly, because you mentioned it, to your time volunteering at the Seasteading Institute. This is like one of the things that sort of got me interested actually in sort of this cutting edge frontier tech. I think you call it sort of like sci-fi stuff that can actually maybe happen in real life. The Seasteading concept has always been really interesting to me, and then sort of bridged me into, you know, okay, maybe we don't have to build cities on the ocean. Like, that might be sort of harder than necessary version, but, you know, can we do like charter cities, or are there other ways to sort of experiment with, you know, these cities being able to govern in new and innovative ways and start very small and potentially scale, or at least have their lessons that are learned from them and successes applied to, you know, larger cities and larger countries. Have you sort of have your thoughts on that space like developed at all over time, or, you know, has your interest in that space maintained? I'm curious to hear sort of the evolution of that particular interest on like the city building realm.
Well, I got into seasteading a long time ago. So that was 15 years ago. I was 23. I was at my most libertarian, probably, maybe not my most libertarian, but certainly my most anarcho-capitalist that I ever was. I really was taken in by the idea of two things. One, of just building politically autonomous cities. And then two, meeting lots of other anarchists. And that's just like the stage of my life that I was in. I would say I was reading all of the writers. I was super plugged into the scene. And the idea of building a country from nothing was just exciting. And there were parallels at that point that I was interested in. So building a city from scratch was really exciting to me, specifically and this sounds kind of silly, but Walt Disney World was a huge influence on me. Just the fact that it existed was exciting. I grew up going there as a kid, and I saw that they had, you know, their own public transportation and their own garbage facilities, and they grew some of their own food and their own power stations and things like this. And it was so well run. I've always been interested in, like, if you could start over, what would that look like? And so that was what got me into the idea of seasteading. I think it was just a super ideological, optimistic space full of ideological, optimistic people. And I would say that over the years, the way my thinking is transformed or changed is just, I'm a little bit less ideological and a little bit more pragmatic. So nothing really came of the Seasteading Institute. And not much yet has come from, I would say the philosophical progeny of seasteading would be something called the Charter Cities Movement. And that seems a little more grounded in reality, also very hard, and haven't seen much by way of, you know, great success in America just yet. I've sort of grown, and I'm reluctant, because I don't know that this is the right solution. I don't know that I'm in the right place. I don't know that I'm focusing on the right thing. But where I am right now is I'm interested in local politics, which is incredibly unsexy and really difficult and full of people who have really perverse incentives. But I don't see another way to fix any of the problems in the country. I think you like have to just get involved in this really shitty situation to change things. The Charter Cities Movement, seasteading especially, was like, well, fuck this. We'll just start the whole thing completely over. And I don't know. I look around. It's been 15 years. There's no progress. So I think it's sort of like the best time to get involved in local politics in a place like San Francisco for me would have been 15 years ago when I was excited about seasteading. And the second best time would be today, though I'm in Miami. So I think this is a problem across the whole country. Everybody needs to be more engaged locally. And again, yeah, it's not exciting, but it's not nearly as exciting as seasteading, but I think it's like, it's what we have and it's where we have to focus.
Yeah, I think sort of the multi-pronged approach makes some sense. You've got these projects like Prospera or even Cul-de-Sac in Arizona, Praxis. There's a few sort of companies or projects that are working in and around this, can we build a city from scratch space? And then, you know, there's also sort of less sexy, maybe not VC backed, just like charter city projects that are going on around the world. But then also you come at it from the other angle, like that's sort of the ideologue side. And then you come at from like, okay, maybe, you know, if we can't get these fresh starts, if it's not as easy as it sort of seems in the dreams, let's go and try to reform some local government issues that we're having, obviously highlighted in San Francisco, but lots of cities in the country. I'll sort of, and I should mention actually during COVID when, you know, cruises were, basically going out of business, obviously they've recovered since, but I was sort of hoping that some rich tech person would like snap up a cruise ship during that time and like, you know, see what they can make of a seasteading thing, even if it's not like fully permanent, at least, you know, do some number of months.
I think back during COVID, I tweeted about cruise ships. I think it was like, because I was, why, you know, you have 7,000 homeless people on the street. Why can't we just buy a few cruise ships and take care of this problem tomorrow? Just dock them at the port in San Francisco and staff them and we're good to go. Homelessness solved.
Yeah, it's funny. It makes sense. I hesitate to bring this up, but I feel like I have to because you know, you've got like Hereticon and you're all about, you know, saying these things that are sort of supposed to be unsaid. But my thing with homelessness for a long time has been, regardless of whether it's a cruise ship or whatever it is, like these people in San Francisco, you walk around and like these people are having, it's just terrible. Like it's not good. There's no way for a human to live. And so my sort of maybe overly controversial thing would be, you know, it should be basically illegal to be homeless. And, if you are in a homeless situation, obviously a lot of these people are, you know, crazy and, you know, medicated and whatever, but then some are just kind of down on their luck. Regardless of who you are, you should be sort of like brought to some place that gives you, you know, ample food and shelter and a place to sleep and like a reasonable human life for a relatively minimal cost. That's probably a lot less than paying for all their, you know, clean needles or whatever else it is. And like, That's just, I guess, controversial a little bit on like freedoms, but we've got tons of stuff that's illegal, and the homelessness problem obviously hasn't been solved and it's only gotten worse. So gotta be some kind of solution.
What's the infringement on freedom here?
That you just like are not allowed to be homeless.
Sleep outside.
Yeah. Like it's public territory. Like you can't be on it. You have to have like your own private land or something.
I think that you look around and you see what happens when you allow it. And if provided that you have an alternative that is safe and clean.
Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about jail here or like anything. It's like a reasonable place to live. That's like comfortable.
Your option is the free bed that we are giving you, or you move along.
Yeah. So anyway, we won't go too deep into that. I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir on some, you know, controversial ideas, and you guys, I think it's actually really interesting. I'd love to hear about sort of Hereticon and how that came about. Maybe we can just tangent into that real quick. I think you guys held the first one this past year.
It was 2022. So Hereticon was an idea that I had back in 2018 or early 2019. And it was set to take place March of 2020. Back then, it's hard to really talk about Hereticon without bringing us back to sort of the headspace we were all in the late 20 teens. And at that time, it was sort of like wokeness was pervasive. This cultural authoritarianism, the sort of culture of, I would say, intolerance when it comes to different ways of thinking or different ideas, anything that was deemed not completely standard, I would say pretty far left politically, was relentlessly attacked, called anything from, you know, it was like always racist, sexist. They would find racism everywhere. And it was just like it was a culture of silence, I would say. It was a culture in which more than half of the country couldn't speak. And it wasn't just political, right? So like things were dragged into the political, but it was actually like, you would see this in the sciences. You would see this when it came to the strange questions of psychology or parapsychology, like the really weird stuff. Like you couldn't even talk about like UFOs. It was a weird time to be interested in ideas in America. In the sciences, what I saw was you'd have like physicists, for example, who had a controversial opinion on one was dark matter. He didn't believe that it existed. He was completely banned from the world of physics. He wasn't invited to conferences. All of his colleagues called him, you know, insane or whatever. And maybe he was, but like, why not be able to talk about that? And biology, you saw that in the praxis of biology, which is maybe biohacking, where people who believe in something like radical self-determination, they have a right to their own body, are completely marginalized from the community. And then eventually came COVID, but that was a little bit later. It interrupted the conference. The point of the conference was, you know, at the height of you can't talk about anything, what if we talked about everything? What if we had a conference for people banned from other conferences, was kind of how I built it. And it was just going to be a party, which also at the time seemed super, super, super not allowed. The idea of having fun. There were always these crazy articles going after the tech bros for these wild parties they were having, which is like, not even accurate. There were no parties. It was like nerds, right? Like it wasn't happening, but I was like, maybe it should happen. Maybe we should be a little bit of the villain that they say we are. And we did that. We just had a celebration of wrong think, I would say, like all of the things that you're not supposed to say out loud. And we did it in the context of a party in Miami. It was fun. It was exciting. But it didn't happen for a few years because obviously COVID happened, everything was canceled. It punted it until 2022 when all was finally said and done. It was January. So it was like really the end of 2021. We were gearing up towards it to do it. And at that point, culture was already shifting pretty fast to the point where, you know, I released the idea in 2019. I was called a Nazi for things like, I mean, like really basic. It was crazy to be called specifically a white supremacist. I build the conferences we were talking about, like, I built some of the topics. It was like UFOs. It was like sex work. It was, I think there was at that point, the biohacking stuff was in there. It was like very vanilla. What feels to me today very vanilla. It was dragged immediately into the political and framed this way. But by 2022, it was like people were saying, I mean, same exact billing, very similar topics. They were like, this isn't heretical enough. Like culture was already changing. I think we got it sort of just at the right point to early 2022. And at this point now, the trick is like, I mean, how do you do something like that? I think the culture has shifted significantly. I think the Overton window is very broad, or not very broad, but it's broad enough where people feel basically comfortable sharing their ideas again to a certain extent. And I think that's a healthy change. I don't know what the future of something like Hereticon is in a culture like that. Like, you know, does the culture still need Hereticon? I think yes, but probably not in quite the same manifestation. I think it'll look a little bit different when we bring it back.
Yeah, it definitely feels like, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, somewhere around that time, maybe 4 years ago, like that whole the whole phenomenon that you were describing sort of peaked, fortunately. And now I don't think it's like you're totally in the clear to say whatever you want. Like, I was hesitant to even talk about the homeless solution earlier. There's also, you know, I guess leveraged media where you're saying it and you don't necessarily know who's listening. Is always a little bit of a different beast. But that was actually, you know, part of when I started doing what I'm doing with, you know, the podcast and blog and whatnot in late 2019. That's like at or around that peak time that you're talking about. And part of the reason why I did things pseudonymously was like, I don't even consider myself a very controversial person. I don't really have like that many really super controversial concepts that aren't at least like reasonably supported in some way. And yet I was still sort of like, well, I don't really want like my old colleagues like seeing these blog posts. Like, I want to be able to write about whatever I want to write about and not worry about it. And at that time, it was just absolutely insane the types of things that were considered controversial that were just like not only not controversial, but like correct.
Things like due process. That was the big one for me. Like the idea that due process would be considered controversial. Free speech would be considered controversial.
Yeah, just a crazy time. So outside of Hereticon, you've also, you know, you mentioned you've sort of run the media efforts for Founders Fund for years now. You've been there for, I think you mentioned like 12 years or so. So it's a long time. I actually didn't realize until sort of doing deeper diligence here in the last week or so how long you've been there and, you know, contributing, going back all the way to, you mentioned like Thiel's class at Stanford. Were you actually a part of like the year when, you know, Blake Masters was there and did the notes that became 0-1?
Blake was not at, was he a, I think he, maybe he was an intern. I'm not actually sure. He worked at Thiel Capital.
No, but for the startup class, I mean, the
he wasn't a part of the class at all.
He
was in the class. He had been taking notes, but that wasn't a part of like building it. That was all me and Scott Nolan, with Peter, obviously. We were the ones who, I mean, we distilled the thinking, we collected the thoughts into chapters, we built all, I mean, every chart you see in that book came from us, all the titles are ours. The thinking obviously is Peter's, but that was us, and that was the first thing I was brought on for, is really an editorial job, for what became his book 0-1. And 0-1 is just basically verbatim his class. Yeah, I was not just a part of that. I would say I was a central part of that. And then Blake, after those notes, he ended up working at Thiel Capital and working on, I think it was the book for a while with this guy, Jimmy Caltrader, and then other stuff there that I'm not entirely sure of. Thiel Capital is a slightly separate entity. It is a totally separate entity from Founders Fund. We're friendly with those guys, but like, I don't know the structure as well.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your contributions to the book, because that was, you know, very important book for me.
It was one of the most important experiences of my life. Peter is great. He gave me an amazing opportunity, and it really like changed everything for me.
Yeah, I think it changed a lot for a lot of people. Obviously, being a part of it is a different story, but phenomenal book and just very principled. I enjoyed it a lot and have read it a couple times actually over the last several years. But another thing, you know, outside of that, those sort of like the earliest days of your work there, and then we're talking about Hereticon, something newer, but you've always sort of been poking around with like different things you're doing on the media side. There was like Anatomy of Next, which was a podcast as well as like articles and things for, I was listening to the podcast. I don't know quite as much about the articles, but there's like 50 episodes, I think, ending a few years ago. And now Pirate Wire seems to be like, it's more of your personal thing than it is, I guess, attached to Founders Fund. But can you talk through a little bit about how like the evolution of this brand or your own independent from Founders Fund media brand have sort of come about, and you know, where you're at with Pirate Wire's sort of as of now?
Yeah. So Founders Fund is a co-founder in Pirate Wires and also an investor. So they're closely linked, and I still work, I have a full-time job at both places. And they're like undeniably sort of interwoven and connected. Like I can't really separate the two. And that's just how I've always done my work. My work is I put everything I have into everything that I do. Because if I don't, it's for self. I can't focus if I can't be myself wherever I am. And so I find ways to kind of weave it all together. My cultural interests, my interest in science and technology, my interest in media, politics, philosophy, like that's in everything that I do. Anatomy of Next was a purer, like it was more science, technology, positive optimism. You know, I started that show, God, I think it was like 6 years ago when that first came out. And it's funny to see, like, you have these like sort of techno-optimistic people on Twitter now. And I've gotten in trouble from some of them who say that I'm not like optimistic enough. And that's what I did. Like I, long before these people were around, I was doing this in a vacuum of that. And I felt like really proud of the quality of that show, Anatomy of Next. And also like it never quite, it was hard to know who was listening, right? It wasn't the same as writing or something on Twitter where you get a feedback immediately. But I loved it. It was a labor of love, I would say, to a certain extent. And I got a bunch of listeners and the show I did, you know, for Founders Fund. As the culture became more intolerant of every kind of, I would say, dissent that existed, like a lot of what I was doing in Anatomy of Next, I was reporting on things that were fascinating to me and exciting to me, but also were increasingly controversial throughout the media. And we kind of entered as America this, I would say in the late 20 teens, we entered this like cultural wartime moment where nothing was safe. And I certainly felt like my friends, the people who were working on things, either building companies or working on exciting new technologies or science, working in the field of science or one of the fields within the field of science, I felt like they weren't really safe. You know, everybody was under attack. And that was coming from the media, and the media itself was becoming a more chaotic environment because of the maturation of social media. With so many more people online, it just became harder to understand what was going on. It was just like a nasty, loud place where the good stuff couldn't really grow. And inside of that, maybe at its worst is when the pandemic started, and that's when everything kind of went just to shit, right? And I was kind of at the most depressed I ever was. I wrapped up the third season of Anatomy of Next. Then it was the summer of 2020, that sort of miserable summer. And I just started writing longer form for something called Pirate Wires, which became like, to a certain extent, I say like creatively, like Anatomy of Next is peacetime and Pirate Wires is wartime. It was me sort of fighting for space for people who I cared about, is how I think about it at its original point. And today it's like, it's that plus just clearing up the clutter and I would say translating the chaos into signal and like finding just what is the message? Like, what do people have to know about what's going on today to be in technology or science or just, you know, in the world? And that's how, I guess that's how I evolved creatively and how I evolved my work creatively. At this point, it's like, I think we achieved a lot of what I wanted to. Back when I started Pirate Wires, I think the sort of war between media and tech feels not nearly as bad as it once was. I think the culture war is super played out. I don't want to even be talking about it anymore. Not in the sort of nasty way. There's some of this stuff is just too fun. Like I'm following the Snow White controversy and it's just like, it's like catnip for me. I mean, like I need to know like every detail. In general, it's like, we got to get back to the stuff that was exciting, you know, before all this sort of went to shit. I want to be writing more about, I don't know, the stuff that inspires me and less about the stuff that makes me feel threatened.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's evident that you're starting to sort of shift in that direction or transition in that direction. I was reading some of the pieces on the new publication, The White Pill, earlier, you know, under the Pirate Wires brand. And I think for anyone who's questioning you on Twitter or whatever about like not being positive enough, just link them to that, because like it's all extremely positive. You've got like Pirate Wires obviously covers a wide variety of topics, and the industry is more sort of like just news and like just sort of facts and things like this. But The White Pill is just like pure techno optimistic inspiration sort of stuff.
Yeah, and, that was my, so that comes from my managing editor runs that, Brandon. And he early on was just like, the stuff that people love about your writing, he went right to the links. He was like, the stuff that people love and want, maybe even need, are the moments that you talk about these crazy science, ambitious science projects or engineering projects, like the big sort of geoengineering stuff and just cool, optimistic. And I thought, wow, like, and he wanted to do a newsletter just on that stuff. And I thought, actually, yes, like, let's get back. Let's remember who we are. Let's remember what it was that we were fighting for in the first place. And it's been really exciting to watch that flourish. And there is an appetite for it. People want it. People want to believe in something better. And they want permission, I think, to just be positive and happy and like progressive in the way that is like, we are progressing as a people towards something better. I think they want to kind of slip back into that. So that's where we are, kind of hitting it from every angle.
Yeah, I forget who was saying it the other day, but someone was saying like the term progressive got like sort of hijacked, and like we kind of want it back for like the actual good version. It's like not something that we associate, most people like sort of associate positively now. It's sort of like the far left or whatnot. But
yeah, I consider myself progressive. Like I am, it's like there's no other word for it. You want to progress society, like what are you left with? You have to be, because there are people who just fundamentally don't believe that there's progress at all. I don't think that's the left. Like, I think the left does believe in progress. They just have progress for the far left, let's say, is communism. And that's not progress to me, but that's how they see it. They see it as progressing towards that ultimate communist ideal. There are plenty of people who don't really want things to change at all. And they want to, you know, they want to go backwards a little bit, use a little bit less energy, you know, live off the land. There's a right-wing version of this and a left-wing version of this right now. And I'm certainly not that. I am progressive, technologically progressive. I am, I think, politically progressive. I'm culturally progressive. I believe in a better world that we should be working towards.
Yeah. And I want to go back actually and talk about, so I guess to try to separate this a little bit, and maybe you'll disagree with this, but we sort of talked about like sort of the freedom of speech versus not being able to say anything. That's like sort of one axis. And then like on another sort of separate spectrum, there's just sort of like the raw positivity and negativity. And like, while I think we've come past the peak of, you know, being able to, people can sort of speak more freely now, I think the prevailing narrative, especially around tech, remains extremely pessimistic and negative. And we still have like a ton of work to do there. And obviously, you know, the White Pill's helping a lot, you know, your tweets are helping, a lot of what you're doing with Pirate Wires is helping. But I found like this old article that you actually wrote in, going back again, like 9 or 10 years in Wired. And the title was like, "Stop Writing Dystopian Sci-Fi. It's Making Us All Fear Technology."
Yeah, this was like my first entrance into, I was nervous in the earliest years at Founders Fund. I didn't want to be public speaking or writing. I wanted to be in a supportive role of people who I really admired on the team. And I wanted to kind of help them tell their story. And then over the years, I gradually got more into just leaning into my natural interest, which is, you know, writing, speaking, tweeting, like this kind of stuff. That was the first piece of mine that was like my kind of coming out party, I would say. It was that piece. And that was like my first beat as a writer. It was science fiction.
Well, so what was crazy about it, or one part of it at least, was that, I don't know, last time you went back and read it, but you start in the intro, you're talking about how You know, there's a couple of Ebola cases in the US, so there's a threat of an outbreak, and there's rumors of the possibility of Russia invading Ukraine, and AI fears are getting out of control. And it's like, wow, like here we are, we had a pandemic, Russia's invaded Ukraine, and AI is way better, and fears are accordingly much higher than they were back then. So it was prescient, I think, in more ways than one. But on this, you know, we've talked about like the news cycles and things like this, but and, you know, the white pill, talking about some of these big developments in space and energy and whatnot. But let's talk a little bit about like the fiction. Like, I don't know if you have any interest in producing fiction through or under Pirate Wires itself or more generally, but why has fiction gone in such a negative direction when it comes to technology? And can you think of any, you know, approach to fix it?
Fiction has always been pretty negative, especially when it comes to science and technology. I mean, there are all these outliers, and especially years ago, Peter always wants to talk about the Jetsons and things like this. And that's true. Like that was, you know, there was this vision of the future that existed that really permeated our culture in like the 50s and the 40s. Not in their 40s, really it was the 50s. That's like when that was the height of it that you saw this. But the first science fiction novel, I mean, was that not Frankenstein? Like, I think that from the earliest days, it was the fear of cells. And so I'm reluctant to really diagnose society with some kind of sickness based on the fiction that we're consuming. I think that what happens actually is dystopian science fiction is much easier to write because there's so much tension in the story. And it's hard to imagine a world in which science and technology have solved so many of your problems, but actually there's still tension. It's like a tricky puzzle for a writer just who wants to tell a good story that's gripping and fun and whatever. So that I think is like ground floor where the problem begins. But then when you're telling these stories, like regardless of why you did it, just because it's easy and you're lazy, the effect is, yeah, it does tend to terrify people. Like you tend to be telling stories about the future that are only negative. And, you know, the culture just absorbs that, internalizes that. And so today it's like we talk about artificial intelligence. There are no story that I can think of, one story that has been told that you can point to and say, oh, there's this positive version of this thing that we're building. Every version of artificial intelligence is negative in film, in television, other than I think the movie Her. And that movie was not even like produced by a science fiction director. That was, I think, wasn't that Spike Jonze? Yeah. And it's, you're told, if you read up on it, it's like there are all these different versions of what that movie was about. And the big one is like about, it's like healing from divorce and loss of love and things like this. It's, the themes are not science fiction. The themes are not, you know, politics, philosophy of the future and things like this. It's like, it's a metaphor for something else, but I think it's a beautiful movie. And I think the importance of it is like almost incalculable, because when you're building this stuff, everyone who is building this stuff, there are no bigger fans of science fiction than the people who work in the technology industry. Everybody refers back to some book that was meaningful to them, and more often than not, what they're referring back to are like basically dystopian things, because that's all that there is. It's like this desert of anything else, and that stuff gets baked into what we build, even if inadvertently. And I think it's important to show people some kind of better future that they can work towards. And yeah, you need tension still. So you put that future at risk. Like you create something that's beautiful and exciting. Star Trek did this really well. There was an entire future that was just like really exciting in terms of technology and our interactions with it. But then it was like, you know, the Borg show up and you have to do something. And I think that's how you keep it exciting, is you threaten the very best that we can produce by something external. And then we come together and we solve it. We solve that problem as a people.
Yeah, I would love if some of this stuff, obviously you've got sort of background, a long background in media and even before Founders Fund, working in books and things like this and thinking about narratives. I would love if some sort of fiction type of
optimism
comes out of Pirate
Wars. I wrote a book called Citizen Sim. It's not in print anymore, so you can't get it. I wrote the sequel. I never published that. This was years ago. I did it for a new media company, like me. I was 26, I think. It was like, you know, no, maybe 28. I think it was like eight, 8-9 years ago, nobody knew who I was back then. I had no audience online. I had nobody who I could sell the book directly to. And that's how publishing works. Like if you don't have an audience that you can sell your, that you can sell your book to, or you're not, you know, ghostwriting a biography for someone famous that the publishing company is going to throw all of their money into promoting or whatever, your book's going to be published to die. And now, you know, the world's changed for me. I have an audience that does care about my writing, and I know that I can sell a science fiction book directly to them. It's a better time to publish it. And I've been sitting on it. It's maybe time to kind of revisit that. I was just telling my colleague at Founders Fund, Trey Stevens, about this, because he's thinking over some ideas too, himself, in terms of science fiction. On Pirate Wires, the future of Pirate Wires is a media company. There will absolutely be room for fiction. Right now, it's like we're building the first sort of core product, and that's going to be, it's a news product. So it'll be a minute before we get there.
Yeah, I think I'd love to read the book. I did stumble upon it in diligence and was sort of wondering what that was all about. And the sequel sounds great too. So maybe, you know, even though it's out of print or whatever, either you could get it going again, or maybe the easiest one would just be to get it up on Kindle and see how receptive your audience is to it. I'm sure, you know, a ton of people would go after it. I would certainly do it. So that's interesting. But one sort of interesting question that I think also comes into play when you're talking about, obviously, you know, the dystopian stuff can be a little bit easier than some of the positive visions for the future. The tech industry, obviously, and, you know, venture capitalists and all the way down would love to have these more positive views of the future. And so there's a question that sort of arises of like, well, how do you actually make that happen? Like outside of going and doing it yourself, like what does the funding of something like that look like? Whether it's like a media company or a movie or like a YouTube, you know, channel or whatever it might be. And I'm sort of, I'm curious your thoughts on this. Obviously Pirate Wires, it sounds like, was partially, Founders Fund invested in Pirate Wires. And I'm not sure what the exact like funding dynamic was there, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on sort of like the best way to fund media companies, if it's sort of worth going and trying to start some, like, you know, the next Mr. Beast, discover the next Joe Rogan, whatever it is. Not, I mean, he was pretty discovered when he started the podcast, but even still, like, you know, these things go on, and there is like a power law dynamic similar to venture in terms of these, like, you know, media creators who blow up. Is there room for like innovation in the way that these things are funded, where maybe some more traditionally tech oriented VCs could go and start funding some of these, you know, media companies or movie makers, YouTube people, whatever it might be?
I'm sure there's something that I haven't thought of. And eventually someone will think of something interesting, and but it won't be me. I don't see it. I think that it's never been easier in the history of the world to get online and say something. And if it connects and you have an audience, you have an audience, and that's how they're built now. And if you don't, and you don't, then you don't. And like, I don't know that there's a way for someone who's not the creative person to figure that out before it's happening. You see little inklings of it on Twitter. You'll see people sort of start to pop off on YouTube and whatnot, people who join the show or whatever. But in general, we're in this open world now where you have the tools. It doesn't cost anything. Nothing's stopping you. That's why I never really care about these conversations about like, you know, the system is keeping this or that kind of person out of media. It's like, nothing's keeping anybody out of media. No one gave me a platform. I wrote for years and years and years and years and years and built a platform. And it wasn't even really until recently that it took off, right? Like people want to say, oh, well, Founders Fund, it's like the brand. It's like, I didn't have a platform for most of my time at Founders Fund. When I had the platform it was for most of my life, I was nervous to be honest about my opinions online because I was writing fiction, not nonfiction. And I didn't want my fiction, my ambition, my dream was to be a professional fiction writer. I wanted to write science fiction. I wanted to write young adult fiction, adventures, action. I wanted to do movies and television. And I wanted to be seen as a creative person, not as a political person. And I was really worried that if people kind of knew how I thought about politics and whatnot, I'd be outcast. And then I worked at Founders Fund, and I didn't want my opinions to impact my colleagues negatively. It was really important to me to be uplifting my team and not exposing them more than they already were. It wasn't until I decided that what we really needed was someone to sort of fight back that I started offering my opinions. I started being more honest. And at that point, like, it really was almost an overnight shift. It was like, I changed my profile pic. It was no longer me. It was Ulysses S. Grant. I started speaking a little more honestly. And the moment I started speaking a little more honestly, I started gaining more followers. I started getting more attention. I started gaining more readers. That just grew and grew and grew until COVID, when I started writing long form. And that's when it really went, like, just, you know, it's just spiked upward. It rocketed upward from that point. And that came from me just using the tools at my disposal, to speak. And so what is the future of, like, funding those things? I don't know. I don't know that, first of all, they even need funding, which is one of the big problems. Like, the average person doesn't. I took funding because I wanted to do something a little more ambitious than just me with a mic. I want to build a team. I want to really cover the news. That's a little bit beyond just, like, sort of me out there being an influencer, but I don't know. Like, I don't know that you need the money. I know that people want to spend the money. I know that people want to invest the money, and you're going to see people try and find the next Mr. Beast and things like that and do it. I just don't know that the next Mr. Beast needs it necessarily.
Yeah, I guess the reason I think of it is more so, like, you mentioned, you know, you're writing for years and years and years before anything clicks, and getting, even if it's just a one-man show to begin with for a long time, I wonder if raising some capital to give you some runway to just sort of produce and see if you sort of are able to hit the bend in the hockey stick could sort of, like, to your point, there's nothing preventing people from creating content and things like this, but how many people might be willing to sort of go more full time on doing what they're doing, maybe currently as, like, a side project or whatever, and just spend time on it for years and see, sort of give it a real go. Of course, you could do it without the money, but I just wonder if that would sort of move the needle on some people who sort of otherwise might not have the, you know, courage or whatever you might call it to sort of take the leap. But coming back to, you know, your big break, you talked a couple times about, like, you know, fighting for space. It's a very interesting sort of story that you mentioned with being, it certainly resonates with me on, like, whenever I'm, you know, employed, I sort of am concerned about being, like, just very out there online, because it's like, well, I don't want to reflect. It's not even like I don't want to reflect poorly. I just don't want to, like, I feel like if I'm working for someone, I sort of represent them and that brand and my colleagues, and I'm hesitant to be who I otherwise am, you know, like when I'm not employed and can just be myself. There's like a little bit of just a tiny bit of friction there. That's sort of the difference between posting and not posting, or writing and not writing, or whatever it is. And the thing that it sounds like was able to take you over the hump on that was this sort of urge to go and, like, fight for space for the people that you believed were sort of, like, doing good things and being treated unfairly. Are there specific examples or any particular instance you can remember from that?
I mean, time? Yes, but there's nothing that I can say that won't implicate someone else and make them seem like they needed someone to defend them or whatever. And I don't want to.
Sure.
I don't want to do that. But.
That's fine. We can.
It was genuinely from a place of, like, no one is defending this person who's being unjustly persecuted for something they didn't even do. Meanwhile, their net impact on the world is overwhelmingly positive, more than 99.9% of the people on the planet. And I'm not going to just sit by and watch them be attacked anymore. I'm going to jump in and say something about it.
Yep. So let's talk about something that's actually positive. I saw you tweeted the other day, 40,000 American, well, this part's not positive, but 40,000 Americans killed by human drivers. But the positive piece of that is that, of course, San Francisco has approved legislation so Waymo and Cruise can do their full self-driving
Well, California approved it. California.
Oh, California did.
The rule was, the decision was taken out of the hands of San Francisco, or it was never placed in the hands of San Francisco. It was run by the state. Program started 5 years ago, and now they've approved it. The city is, it's as important because the city is resisting it at every step of the way, and now they're trying to reverse the decision.
Yeah, I think this is like one of the most underrated things. Like, I've been, you know, talking about it for a long time about, like, even during COVID, like at its peak, if you sort of compared it, I don't have the numbers like fresh in my mind, but the number of just, if, you know, forget America, worldwide, the number of like road traffic accidents that are, you know, fatal is like so ridiculous. And we just accept it as, you know, this, it sort of happened like gradually over time as cars became a thing. And so like when something's gradual instead of overnight, like the pandemic, we tend to not, you sort of just like, it's like, you know, boiling the frog or whatever. You just like sort of get used to it slowly over time, and then you never react. But I can't believe, like, to me, the government should be not only not blocking this stuff, but like giving as much possible support in terms of regulation and also like assistance with funding or whatever. It should be like a national priority to get all of our roads to be fully self-driving, like autonomous vehicles, because you can basically, I mean, I think even with the technology that's around today, I don't know exactly what the numbers are again, but it's like you could get like 90% less car traffic deaths just implementing the technology that, like, for example, Waymo, Cruise, and Tesla have today. And obviously these things are continuing to improve. So just crazy to me. And it's good that obviously things are taking at least a step in the right direction. But maybe in closing, I know we've only got a few minutes left, but you talked at the top of the episode when we were talking about the city building and stuff like this, that actually your opinion has shifted a bit to where like local politics is actually like sort of the most important area to get involved. And obviously, you know, people are hyper focused on this in San Francisco, which, you know, you wrote about sort of the tech people leaving and had a great article on that. And now, you know, people are saying, well, SF is back, it's the place to be, whatever. But there's still these issues with local politics. Obviously, you've moved yourself, it sounds like, but do you have thoughts on sort of the current state of San Francisco and, you know, how you think about
it? Right, so I live in Miami. I'm in SF for work, well, once a month. And I love San Francisco. People often mistake me as like an anti-San Francisco person. It's the only city in America. I love New York, but it's different. It's like New York's my home city. It feels, my mom's from New York. It's like my family rather than like my chosen love. San Francisco is the place that I just really want what's best for it. And what motivates me on the local political discussion there is just like, there are people who are destroying it and it seems like they're doing it on purpose. And the only way to stop that is to get involved. And so when you see people excited about San Francisco and they're like, you know, return and all of this, again, it's this like, it's this techno-optimist group of people. They just have no sense of history whatsoever. And they have no sense of engagement. They tend to not be involved at all. And that's not even a criticism of them. It's like, that's what we all were 10 years ago, 12 years ago. No one was paying attention. And like, what results is this? The difference is that 10, 12 years ago, everybody was excited about what tech was doing, not just within tech, but in the country. People, Uber was like magic when that became a Lyft, Uber, Airbnb. People were still extremely excited about social media. 12 years ago, people wanted to work at Facebook. That was still considered cool. We were in a different time. We are now entering a uniquely negative anti-tech sort of cultural moment. And then San Francisco, the purported capital, it is the cap. I mean, let's just be honest. It is the capital of the tech industry. That is like one of the most negative on tech that exists in the country. It's going to be very hard. We can talk about how awesome self-driving cars are until we're blue in the face. It is going to become a labor issue. It's already a labor issue in Sanford. That's the real reason people are opposing it. It's the unions are mad about it. They just see it as a job killer. And so they don't care how safe it is. They don't care how many lives are protected. They see this as like, you're getting rid of jobs, trucking jobs, driving jobs. It's like those Uber jobs that they ridiculed for the last 10 years is not good enough. They're now like, don't you dare take those Uber jobs away. that's the fight. It's going to be a political fight. It's going to be a local political fight. And so like, you can talk about tech optimism until you're blue in the face. If you're not actually involved at this level, at the unsexy level, when it's like, we have to stop this piece of legislation. And that requires talking about something that's really not popular online, which is like voting for stuff, then I don't want to hear it from you anymore, because I care about actually improving things. And that's, it's like there's the positive story that you tell as a part of that. But you have to be willing to get in the mud and fight for it as well.
Definitely. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how things play out there. It seems like it's been a volatile few years, but people are starting to maybe pay attention to some more of the right things and get involved. So anyway, I know we're up on time, so I want to thank you for, taking the time and coming on. It's been awesome talking with you. And, I want to give you the last word if there's anything else that comes to mind that you didn't get a chance to share that you'd like to, but also just sort of pointing people to, where they can go and continue to follow along. And I know I, for one, I'm going to continue to, enjoy Pirate Wires and, the White Pill and everything going on there, including Pirate Wires podcast. I should mention people should go listen to that as well.
Sure. Subscribe to piratewires.com, piratewires.com. And follow me on Twitter, Mike Solana.